Hello and welcome to Managing Myeloma. My name is Sagar Lonial and I'm a professor at the Winship Cancer Institute of Emory University in Atlanta. Today I'm talking with Professor Heinz Ludwig from the Wilhelmina Cancer Institute in Vienna, Austria. We're going to talk about highlights from the ESH Third International Conference on Multiple Myeloma. And Professor Ludwig chaired a session on treatment of elderly patients. So that's really what we're going to focus on in the next few moments. Welcome, Professor Ludwig.
Hello. Thank you for having me in.
So what I'd like to do is talk a little bit about some of the important updates that were presented in your session. There were three lectures, one that focused on frontline therapy for fit patients, one that focused on frontline therapy for frail patients, and then your lecture specifically on supportive care, I think in general for myeloma patients, but we'll use this as a launching pad to talk about supportive care for elderly patients. So let's begin with sort of the current state of the art for fit patients in that presentation.
Professor Motti from Paris made a strong point regarding transplant, considering transplantation in fit elderly patients. In my opinion, the term elderly is an umbrella term for a very heterogeneous group of patients. For fit elderly patients between 65 and 75 years of age, he recommended high-dose chemotherapy, followed by autologous transplantation, and stressed that this is a very effective treatment for fit elderly patients. For patients not eligible for transplant but still fit, he proposed a three-drug combination therapy. Professor Motti mentioned several possible combinations but made a strong point for combining an IMiD with a proteasome inhibitor plus dexamethasone.
For those patients in Europe, how often are they receiving a transplant between 65 and 75?
I think this depends on the different policies of the institutions. Some centers recommend a transplant to all fit patients of this age group, while others stick to an age limit between 65 to 70 years. Recently, results of two big trials comparing transplant with conventional therapy have been presented. Both studies showed a clear superiority of transplant in terms of overall response rate, complete remission rate, and MRD negativity rate, as well as longer PFS. But at this point of time, there is no difference in overall survival. One could argue that with longer follow-up, the survival curves may still diverge because it is known that patients with good risk features benefit most from aggressive therapy, and this might be seen in those patients after longer follow-up.
Yeah. So that's a big, I think, point of distinction between the practice in the U.S. and the practice in Europe. There have been now a number of retrospective analyses, in addition to the paper that was published recently in BMT, that have demonstrated the benefit for transplant is the same independent of age. And that analysis went all the way up to 78. So for our patients, I think it's a matter of picking the right patients, recognizing
yes.
that patients over the age of 70 are not going to get MEL-200. They're going to get MEL-140. By dose reducing the melphalan, you do significantly improve the tolerance of a transplant, even for patients in their mid to upper 70s. And, you know, the best example I can give of that is a patient that I took to an auto transplant who was 74, and at day 30 after transplant, he was out playing golf and walking 18 holes a day again. There are patients that can do remarkably well and continue to gain benefit from high-dose therapy almost independent of age. And I think it's important to identify who those patients are and treat them with the appropriate induction therapy so that we don't limit their ability to collect stem cells or to have a stem cell transplant as a potential option for them in the future.
Yes, but when you look at another trial which recently has been published looking at the age-corrected survival curves, the benefit for transplant for patients aged 70 to 75 years was smaller compared to younger patients. But I completely agree, and that was the starting point of our discussion, that there is a big variability in fitness within elderly patients. For transplant, you pick out those who are really fit, and those tend to benefit. I think that is has been shown clearly.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the second talk then, frontline therapy for frail patients. This has been a pretty rapidly moving target, and I suspect we're going to see data in the next 6 to 12 months that's going to make this even more challenging to sort out a little bit. What was sort of the take-home points from Dr. LaRocco's talk?
Dr. LaRocco comes from the Torino team, and the Torino team has established a geriatric assessment instrument, which is available online on the website. Using this instrument, you can easily categorize your elderly patients into three different groups, namely those who are deemed to be fit, unfit, or who are frail. The instrument provides important prognostic information. When you apply this instrument to elderly patients, you find out that those categorized as frail have really a poor outlook, and the discrimination in outcome using the frailty index is much greater than that which you obtain by when you use cytogenetic risk factors. Being frail is a significant disadvantage, of course, and the message of Dr. LaRocco's presentation makes clear that we have to adapt the treatment to the fitness of our individual patients. She recommended similarly to Dr. Modi a triple combination for fit, younger, elderly patients and a very slow-go approach in those who are really frail. Patients who are frail have more complications, don't tolerate treatment as well as fit patients, and even if you reduce the dose, they discontinue treatment more often and earlier, and of course the outcome is much poorer than that of the other two groups. Due to this data, it should become common practice, in my opinion, to assess frailty in clinical practice. In the past, physicians believed that they are quite good in distinguishing fit and frail and from unfit patients, but there are very few studies comparing the physician's judgment with the outcome obtained using frailty instruments. And the comparisons showed that these instruments enable better discrimination than physician's judgment. This is why we need these instruments and why we need to implement these instruments in our daily practice.
So I think development of these instruments is really critical to appropriate triage and management and identification of potential toxicities of therapy as well. What is sort of the general thinking about treatment-wise for a newly diagnosed frail elderly patient? What are the current standards of thought?
I think the Italian group did two trials in patients aged 75 or older, and they compared two drug combinations with three drug combinations, which were either proteasome inhibitor or lenalidomide-based. Interestingly, they found that the triple drug combinations were not superior in those elderly patients. And based on their findings, lenalidomide dexamethasone or bortezomib dexamethasone or a novel proteasome inhibitor plus dexamethasone, these combinations yield similar efficacy in patients, in those elderly patients with somewhat less toxicity. In addition, one has to adapt the dose, and when using bortezomib, you can also modify the frequency of dosing, and in very frail patients, you tend to start not only with a lower dose, but you likely will use longer treatment intervals, simply switching from twice weekly to once weekly, and this enhances the tolerance, and in the end you will obtain probably better results as with an aggressive approach in those elderly or older patients.
And just as a sort of a future consideration and thought, where do you think antibodies might fit in the management of frail patients? My sense is that might allow us to go back to a triplet but because the antibodies are so much better tolerated potentially, if we have the data, obviously.
I completely agree that the antibodies are very well tolerated, and they will be moved into frontline treatment, and then we have a two drug, let's say two conventional drug combo plus an antibody, and that is probably the way to go in the future. For fit elderly patients, there will be many combinations consisting of conventional chemotherapy plus an antibody. But if you think far forward, you can even think about using two different antibodies with different targets, for instance, an anti-CD38 antibody plus a checkpoint inhibitor, or even two different CD38 antibodies which have different targets on the CD38 molecule.
Okay, so let's get to the last section, which was your talk on supportive care. That's certainly been an important part of management of all patients in myeloma, given many of the comorbidities they often present with as a consequence of their disease. What is sort of new and important from your view in terms of supportive care approaches?
I think we should consider that patients with myeloma, when they are started on therapy, carry a high risk for developing infections and infection-induced mortality. When you look at mortality rates in the first 3 to 4 months after start of therapy, you find out that roughly 10 to 20% die because of an infectious complication. Thus, we need to be proactive here because we can probably reduce the incidence of infections and thereby the outcome of our patients. Data from a Scandinavian review showed that the rate of death due to infections remained rather constant at 20% during the whole course of the patient's disease. And this is an alarming high number, in my opinion, and we need to do our utmost to reduce the risk for infections. For instance, myeloma patients have a 7-fold increased risk for influenza, and they have a 10-fold increased risk for bacteria. So even every patient should be vaccinated against influenza, as well as their partners and family members, and importantly, also the care team. In addition, patients should be vaccinated with pneumococcal vaccine and possibly also against Haemophilus influenza. But when recommending vaccination, we should be aware that the chance to develop an excellent antibody response is low in patients with active disease. Thus, ideally, we should vaccinate patients before onset of active myeloma or while they are in very good remission. Proteasome inhibitors inhibit T cell activity, which is important to control latent viral infections. Almost all of us have herpes viruses, and many of us have CMV viruses, about 60%, and other viruses. But when patients are exposed to proteasome inhibitors, the risk of reactivation of latent viral infections increases substantially. Therefore, the patients should be on prophylaxis with acyclovir or valacyclovir. That is standard now. If the patient is on maintenance therapy with a proteasome inhibitor and if his disease is well controlled, it is unclear whether we should continue prophylactic antiviral therapy, but in my opinion, I think it's better to be on the safe side and to continue with this treatment as long as the patient is on a proteasome inhibitor. Thus, when infections occur in myeloma patients, particularly in those with poorly controlled disease, we have to be very careful and consider rapid start of antibiotic treatment even before complete diagnostic workups in order to reduce the risk of severe complications.
So I think the points that you brought up about infectious complications and things are really very important as the survival of patients has grown markedly because of the availability of new agents, preventing common things that in the past we couldn't do a lot about, such as preventable infections, prophylactic infections. Those things are really critically important. I will tell you from our practice, we believe that myeloma itself is a risk factor for developing VZV reactivation or zoster reactivation.
Yes.
And so we actually put people on lifelong acyclovir prophylaxis from the time they're diagnosed, regardless of whether they're on a proteasome inhibitor or not. But I think these are all certainly important discussions. And, in fact, the International Myeloma Working Group is going to update their recommendations on vaccines and supportive care before the workshop in India this year. So we will see an updated panel at that meeting.
There are new vaccines on the horizon, particularly for herpes zoster. Up to now, only an attenuated zoster vaccine is available, and this is presently in clinical trials. It's tested in patients with hematological malignancies. But more recently, a new recombinant vaccine has been shown to reduce herpes zoster incidence significantly in normal elderly people. Hopefully, these vaccines will soon be tested in myeloma patients, and this may turn out to be very helpful, because if that turns out to be safe and effective, then every patient should be vaccinated with these new herpes zoster viruses vaccines before starting proteasome inhibitor therapy. Also, we are well aware of the fact that the response to vaccines in patients with myeloma is much poorer than in normal people. Sometimes, particularly if you have time and if the patient is not really an active disease, it's worthwhile to reconsider repeating the vaccination if the antibody response is not good enough.
Yeah, very, very interesting. And you're right. I think there's a lot of excitement for being able to prevent some of these common and quite debilitating complications.
Patients on longstanding lenalidomide may, in rare instances, develop debilitating diarrhea due to a rare syndrome called bile salt malabsorption syndrome. Some of those patients suffer really significantly from diarrhea. They are afraid to leave their home because they cannot control their bowel movements. And there is a good drug which is helpful in those patients. This is in patients with bile salt malabsorption syndrome. The drug is called Cholestagel in UK. It's Colesevelam. It's a generic name. The drug is not approved for this indication, to be honest, but I think if patients suffer severely from their diarrhea, it's worthwhile to give the patients a try and use Colesevelam tablets. I usually start with 2 tablets, and sometimes I have to increase it to 4 tablets, and usually there's a response within 2 to 3 days. If patients do not respond, I discontinue treatment. You can actually, if you want, you can, of course, make a precise diagnosis of bile salt malabsorption syndrome by using a radioactive bile salts, and you can then test the absorption, but I think it's not needed for clinical practice because you just use it and see whether it's working or not.
Yeah, I'll agree that we've been using that for about a year now. It's remarkable for patients that are on particularly on maintenance, who have the chronic malabsorptive diarrhea. It works very quickly, and it works in almost 90% of patients. It's really very effective.
I agree.
So any last couple sort of important summary thoughts you wanted to make about your session that perhaps we haven't hit already?
Yes, well, we notice all a significant improvement in outcome, and this improvement in survival is much more pronounced in younger patients, but it's getting better in elderly patients as well. And this increase in survival is due to novel drugs, certainly, but it's also due to greater experience of specialized care teams and due to better supportive care. Taken together, several measures contributed to the improved outcome in elderly patients, and we hope to see much more in the years to come.
All right. Well, thank you, Dr. Ludwig, for your highlights that you provided today. and thank you for joining us today. For additional resources, please view the other educational activities on managingmyeloma.com.